All right, welcome back to Healing the Earth Radio here on CFRU. And I have with me a special guest host today, Aaron.
Hey, today we'll be talking with Derek Jensen, who is a writer who is increasingly recognized as a major new voice in cultural dissent. He has written books such as A Language Older Than Words, Welcome to the Machine, Walking on Water, Endgame, and Culture of Make-Believe. Culture of Make-Believe has been called a passionate and provocative meditation on the nexus of racism, genocide, environmental destruction, and corporate malfeasance, where civilization meets its discontents. We're really excited to have Derek with us today.
Yeah, so Derek, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Not too bad, I guess. I'm feeling pretty good. And maybe just to begin, we'll open it up wide, let you introduce yourself. And the first thing we were thinking of asking you was, if you can perhaps tell us a bit about the progression you've made in your major works with Language Older Than Words and Culture Make-Believe and now Endgame. And maybe tell us, you know, what you're trying to contribute to the community of resistance by writing Endgame.
Yeah, that's a really good question. As I mentioned in the email to you, we should just sort of put this on the table so that if something happens, people will know what's going on, is that I've been having a flare-up of Crohn's disease for the past several months, and if I suddenly, in the middle of a sentence, have to run off to the bathroom or something, one of the things it does is causes pretty bad diarrhea. And if I suddenly have to run off to the bathroom, then y'all can just chat for a second. I'll be right back.
No problem.
Anyway, so I guess the progression for me of those books. And I should also, one more thing I should say is that Endgame isn't out yet. Endgame is coming out next spring through Seven Stories. It's going to be in two volumes. Anyway, the progression would be, in a lot of ways, a language over the words is about how you make yourself sane in this insane culture. And then cultural make-believe would be once you do sort of make yourself sane and you look around, what do you see? And then end game would be, so what are you going to do about it? And the fundamental premise of end game, or I guess there's a several premises, of course. One of them is that, you know, I would go all around the country and I would ask people, do you believe that this culture will undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living? And nobody would ever say yes. And a lot of people would just laugh. It's a silly question. And the next question is, so if you don't believe that the culture is going to undergo a voluntary transformation to a sane and sustainable way of living, what does that mean for your strategy and for your tactics? And the answer is we don't know. And one of the reasons we don't know is because we don't talk about it. And one of the reasons we don't talk about it is because we're all so busy pretending that we have hope and pretending there's going to be this magical transformation. So in the meantime, we'll just, you know, do all this little stuff. But you know, frankly, the stakes are way, way too high for that. This culture, the dominant culture, is killing the planet. And then the question becomes, once again, what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, I just want to throw a little quote from your book at you. When I bring up the faults in the government, capitalism, techno-industrial complex, or the culture as a whole, many people get extremely defensive, as if I just insulted their mother. And how do we as activists deal with this defensiveness in our communities? And in general, what do you think about that?
I think that there's two parts to that. One is that on one hand, a lot of people, I guess, do get really defensive. We can deal with that. And another, I mean, there's on the other hand, there's a lot of people recognize increasingly. I mean, it's hard to not recognize that this culture is killing the planet. I mean, take any sort of measure that you want. I mean, 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. There's six times more plastic in the oceans than there is phytoplankton. Phytoplankton populations are collapsing. And when you mess with a phytoplankton, it's really all over. I ask people, so how many of you have had someone you love die of cancer? And 70 to 80% of the people say yes. And I mean, cancer is a disease of civilization and caused in great measure by the toxification of the entire environment. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that, I mean, who's the idiot who first thought of putting poison on our own food, you know, in terms of pesticides? It's just crazy, crazy. And, oh, here's something else I just read the other day. This isn't in the book, but it just makes perfect sense that governments, of all the money spent in all the world, that's governments and individuals, of all the money spent, there's more spent on the military than there is on every other thing in the entire world combined, which means in this case, those in power are spending more to kill others than on everything else combined. Okay, and if you drop off the military, then, you know, if you just leave that money out of the picture, then the next big things that the money is spent on are by people and governments of the world are tobacco, drugs, and alcohol, which means that the second thing, and that's more than everything else in the world combined, which means that the first thing they're doing is killing others, and the second thing they're doing is killing themselves. And that's really, really messed up. And so my point is that there are increasingly suffusing public consciousness. I just read Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Crake. I finished it a couple days ago. And so anybody who's going to read that book in the very near future, shut your ears for a second because I'm going to have a spoiler. But unless I'm mistaken, unless I'm misunderstanding that book, it's in many ways a not unsympathetic portrayal of someone who wants to kill every human on the planet, the character Craig. And it's all because humans are killing the planet. And my point is that that's a national bestseller, it's an international bestseller, and it's suffusing. This knowledge that things are very, very, very wrong is suffusing. And I want to be clear that I'm not saying that we should, you know, kill every human on the planet. I'm not saying that at all. It's that those in power are doing that very well. Thank you very much. What I'm saying is it's suffusing public consciousness enough to make that sort of book possible. And that's an extraordinary, extraordinary thing. Okay, having said that, there is this denial that we do bump into sometimes. And my response actually to the denial a lot of times is to simply talk to someone else, because there are so many people who, I mean, we have to, time is short and we have to choose our audience and audiences. And so if I talk to somebody who then says, you know, how can you possibly say that humans are killing the planet? It's like, you know, I'll give the quick speech on that. It's like, choose your, you know, at what point will you finally allow that? Will it be when the salmon are gone? Will it be when the passenger pigeons are gone? Will it be when the Eskimo curlews are gone? Will it be when, you know, every mother on the planet has dioxin in her breast milk? I mean, give me a threshold at which you'll finally say that. And if none of that works, then I recognize that I'm talking to someone who is a fundamentalist, and I'll just go talk to somebody else. I mean, I've been attacked a few times in my career. In fact, I just got a rejection letter from Sierra Club Books on my zoo book because they said that book is a tirade. And the rejection is part of a writer's life, and that's all. It's fine that they rejected it, but it really bugged me that they called it a tirade, because first off, and this is part of the reason that the world's being killed, is that those who pretend that they are defending the planet so often are afraid of emotion. And I this came through my agent, so I didn't have any contact with the editor at all. But if I would have been in contact with him, I would have said the same sort of thing. It's like, wait a second, you know, at what point will you finally allow that someone can be outraged? I mean, if you go to a zoo and you see these, you know, grizzly bears who've been driven insane by incarceration, and you see all these other horrors that are perpetrated on these animals, then, you know, at what point are you actually going to speak out strongly? And the point here is that another thing they said is that we don't think this book is going to convince anybody. And basically, if presenting the facts in a strong fashion is not going to, the book's on a tirade, by the way, if presenting the facts in a strong manner is not going to convince somebody, then that person can't be convinced. And the whole thing I started with is that I don't write for fence sitters. I write for people who already recognize how messed up things are, and I want to give them courage and push them harder, as other writers have done for me. And actually, I need to run to the bathroom. So can we talk again in just a second?
Of course.
I'll stay on the phone. I won't stay on the phone, but the phone, I'm not going to hang up or anything.
Okay.
Okay, I'll be back in a second.
So this is a quote that was written in Endgame, but it's actually from Ward Churchill, an amazing activist. And he says, "What I want is for civilization to stop killing my people's children. If that can be accomplished peacefully, I will be glad. If signing a petition will get those in power to stop killing Indian children, I will put my name at the top of the list. If marching in a protest will do it, I'll walk as far as you want. If holding a candle will do it, I'll hold two. If singing protest songs will do it, I'll sing whatever songs you want me to sing. If living simply will do it, I will live extremely simply. If voting will do it, I'll vote. But all those things are allowed by those in power, and none of those things will ever stop those in power from killing Indian children. They never have, and they never will. Given that my people's children are being killed, you have no grounds to complain at whatever means I use to protect the lives of my people's children, and I will do whatever it takes."
Hello?
Hey, Derek.
Hey.
Perfect timing. We just read the quote from Ward Churchill.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I wonder if you can maybe talk a bit about that, and as well, perhaps, well, can you share with us your insights? This is two questions in one, but can you share with us your insights from your exploration of the similarities between abusers and personal relationships and abusers of the dominant culture at large, and share with us what this means in terms of our strategies and tactics?
Okay, sure. So you want me to not talk about the Churchill quote, or you want me to talk about that first?
There's a bit of crossover. If you could talk about that first, maybe, and work into the second one.
Okay. By the way, can you hear that in the background? That's my cat wants to be part of the interview.
Right on. Welcome.
By the way, also, Crohn's disease is a disease of civilization. I don't know if you know that, but nobody knows really what causes it, but it's very, even if you set aside the people who don't, I mean, the increased ability of sort of high tech to detect Crohn's disease, if you set that aside, as countries industrialize, the rate of Crohn's disease goes skyrockets. So it's clearly something having to do with either industrial, intoxication of the environment or industrial diet or something. So far as the Ward Churchill quote, that's, you know, I got into an argument not very long ago with someone when I said that the only measure by which we will be judged by those who come after is the health of the land base. And he got really offended and said, you know, no, and people are really going to care primarily about how we get there. And so, you know, we need to, and he was pretty much a pacifist and was saying, you know, we need to, you know, how we get to where we're going is more important than the place to which we end up. And I said, that's not true. What people are going to care about 30, 40, 50 years from now is whether they have food to eat and whether they have, whether they can, they have water to drink, and whether their children are born with, depleted uranium, induced, birth defects, and, you know, we can all move toward this really groovy eco-socialist utopia, and on a planet with runaway global warming, it's not going to matter. I mean, the people ask me, what do you want? I mean, that's a big part of our problem as members of, as not members, but as part of the resistance or part of the revolution or part of whatever we want to call it. A lot of us don't really know what we want. I mean, that's a problem with especially mainstream environmental organizations. It's like, what do you want? Do you want smaller clear cuts? You want fewer clear cuts? You want clear cuts that are only where you don't see them? You know, what do you want? You want to have your car and a planet that is only slightly, you know, less toxic than this culture's making it? And I'm actually really clear on what I want, and what I want is to live in a world that has more wild salmon every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more polar bears every year than the year before. And I want to live in a world that has more migratory songbirds every year than the year before. And, you know, we can go through whatever you want. You know, it's like those are just representative. They're not just representative. They are themselves. And in addition, they're stand-ins. And they're not stand-ins because, once again, the salmon are the salmon. And I want to live in a world that has more wild salmon. And at the same time, I can't go through and list, you know, every single plant and animal and fungi that I care about. I want to live in a world with more wild nature every year than the year before, including wild humans. And I'll do whatever it takes to get there. That really is the only thing that matters. And I'll do whatever it takes to get there. And so once again, if holding candles and praying will do it, sure, but I don't believe that holding candles and praying is going to cut it. And so that's one thing. Oh, and another thing, before we go to the abuse stuff, there's something else I want to talk about from Endgame that I think is pretty fundamental. And in a language older than words, I looked at how the culture is really irredeemable from a personal perspective, that one of the fundamental theses of that book was that we have an entire culture that's suffering from what Judith Herman would call complex post-traumatic stress disorder. And PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, is something that happens if you are if you're traumatized severely once or a few times, you may get PTSD. So, and one of the things that will happen is that you become leery of those things that affected you, that hurt you so badly. So, for example, a woman who is raped in a certain make and model of car, afterwards, you know, if she sees that type of car, she may tighten up. Or I had a cat who died not very long ago, and maybe a month ago, and when she was a kitten, one time, I don't know if you ever do this, but sometimes, you know, I'll put my finger out, and then the cat will come up and touch her nose to your finger. And one time she happened to do that, and I happened to have accidentally been shuffling my feet on the carpet, and so she got an electric shock. And so for probably 3 or 4 years after that, if I ever put my finger out at her, she would bat at my hand. And that's a pretty classic PTSD thing, you know, that I wasn't going to, or the great Mark Twain quote about how a cat who has sat on a hot stove will never sit on a hot stove again, but also never sit on a cold stove. So there's just so many examples. We all heard, you know, the Vietnam War vet who hears a car backfire and, you know, stiffens up and drops or something. And those are all PTSD. And then Judith Herman asks, what happens if you weren't traumatized once or twice or 5 or 10 times, but instead you are traumatized? Oh, and here's another example of the PTSD is that I could never, because of my father's behavior, because of smelling alcohol on my father's breath as he sexually assaulted me, I mean, I could, even if I wanted to, I could never date someone who drinks. I mean, that's just, that connection has been made, and and I don't go there. Okay, so anyway, there's Judith Herman asked, what happens if someone's traumatized not once or twice or five or ten times, but instead, or one more example of PTSD actually is pretty interesting, is when I was in high school, I never used to swear or anything, and if someone would ask me if I wanted to go water skiing, I would say no thank you, but inside my head I'm just cursing them out and I'm furious and I'm it's really, really weird. I want to deal with water skiing. And then I asked my mom, what's the deal? And she said that, and I'd forgotten about this entirely, she said when I was like 3 and 4 and 5, there were beatings associated with the family would go water skiing and somebody would inevitably end up getting beaten. And I had no conscious recollection of that, but once again, every time anybody asked me if I wanted to go water skiing, I would totally flip out. And, you know, once again, we've seen this in various, I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only person who's seen this in various relationships where you can do something entirely innocuous and the other person just flips out because, you know, you've touched some trigger that has nothing to do with the present day. Anyway, so Judith Herman defined this. What happens if you're not traumatized once or twice or three times or five times, but instead you're raised in captivity? You are a political prisoner, or you are a regular prisoner, or you are raised in domestic violence. And what she found is that not only do you get those specific triggers, but you come to believe that all relationships are based on power, based on hierarchy. You come to believe, not believe, but you come to experience that mutuality is not possible. Relationships end up scaring you very much. You could end up an extremely controlling person because if everything around you can hurt you, you need to keep everything under control. You need to control it because, my God, it could come after me. And so that's where she took it. And where I took it, and I want to say that she's not responsible for this part. She may actually disagree with it. I don't know. But I'm saying we have an entire culture that's based on an entire culture where we're all so traumatized that we have forgotten. We can't even conceptualize. We can't even experience what it is to be in a relationship. When I've talked to American Indians, Vine Deloria, Jeanette Armstrong, however many of them, when I say what is the fundamental difference between Western and Indigenous ways of being, they all say the same thing, which is that the Indigenous people perceive listening to the natural world not as a metaphor, but as the way the world really works. And they perceive those others around them as beings to enter into relationships, not as objects to be exploited. So, you know, there's this tree over here. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman. When I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And that's pretty much it, because if when I look at trees, I see dollar bills, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at trees, I see trees, I'll treat them differently. And if when I look at this particular tree that I see right now, I see this particular tree that I see right now, I'll treat it still differently. And it's the same if when I look at salmon, I see a fisheries resource, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at salmon, I see salmon, I'll treat them differently. If when I see this particular salmon, I see this particular salmon, I'll treat it still differently. Or if when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them differently. If when I look at this particular woman, I see this particular woman, I'll treat her differently still. And my point is that we have been so traumatized that we are quite often incapable of entering into all these just wonderful and beautiful relationships. And so we end up perceiving everyone around us, including other humans, as human resources, as resources. And that has really strong effects. We come to believe that all life is based on this hierarchy of power and that we are somehow at the top. And, or actually we're not. I mean, there are those above us who do violence to us and then we do violence to those below us. And so that's all part of what happens when we're raised in this entire culture that's so traumatized that we can't enter into a relationship. That was language. Culture make-believe basically takes that a step further, extends that outward. So it says that it looks at the problem on a sociological level, that basically if you have an entire culture that's based on competition, which of course it will be if we're all traumatized, if you have an entire culture that's based on competition, it's going to lead inevitably to atrocity and to hatred and to objectification. And so in the new book, culture make-believe is how the entire culture is irredeemable as long as we have this system of social rewards. It's great. The anthropologist Ruth Benedict asked why is it that some cultures are really very peaceful and they treat women and children well and they are very synergistic and they're very people are generally really happy, and why in some other cultures are the cultures very warlike, and that's not to say that peaceful cultures can't have war, but it's an entirely different form of warfare. Anyway, this was really a lot more like play than anything else. And with these other cultures that have the really sort of nasty war and that have that treat women poorly and that treat children poorly and that have a lot of competition, what is it that separates them? Why is it that there is this there's this divide? And she said, is it race? No. Is it patrilineality or matrilineality? No. I always thought the patriarchy was the root of all evil, but it's not. It's only like the root of half of all evil. Is it the wealth or poverty of the culture? No. Is the house size? No. And she finally came up with one really simple rule. That is, the cultures that are good, that treat the women well, children well, that aren't exploitative, those cultures recognize that humans are both selfish and altruistic. And they break down that dichotomy by making it so that the most selfish thing you can do is to do things that are good for your community. And they do that by their social rewards. And what you do is you praise people. We recognize that we're social creatures, and you praise people who do things that are good for the community, and you disallow behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the whole. On the other hand, the cultures that are really nasty, those cultures consistently socially reward behavior that benefits the individual at the expense of the whole. And it all comes down to how a culture handles wealth. That if in the cultures that are really good, it's handled through what's called a siphon system, whereby wealth is constantly siphoned from rich to poor. And that's done once again through praise. So if I go hunting and I, you know, kill some animal and then I bring it back and I don't share among the, I never can pronounce this word, XHOSA of South Africa, among them, if someone didn't share down to the tiniest little scrap, everybody would laugh at them like a hyena, and they would make fun of them. In some of the tribes in the Northwest, they would have a shaming pole that you'd put outside somebody's house that says, this person's a jerk. Sometimes you'd get exiled if you don't share. And in the other cultures, you know, it's handled through a funnel system whereby wealth is constantly funneled from poor to rich, and it's a competition. And no wonder you all end up at each other's throats because everybody's competing as opposed to. And the reason, by the way, that if I go hunting, I could give it all away is because I know tomorrow that one of you is going to go gathering, and then you will share. Because right now, I could give away every penny I have, and who's going to pay my rent tomorrow? And this only works if there aren't any cheaters. And so that book was really about how this culture is really deeply based on this, on competition, and how that leads to these horrors, and how the end point of this culture is apocalypse. And then in Endgame, the way I take this whole, I approach this is I talk about how it's irredeemable on a straight physical level. And the way I deal with that is, you know, I've been bashing civilization for a long time, and finally with this book I decided I better define it. And the way I defined it is civilization is a way of life that's characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible both linguistically and historically. And that's all fine, Derek, but what's a city? And a city I've defined as a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources, which means that the people who lived, who have lived where I now live in what's called Northern California, the Talua, they were not civilized. They lived in camps. They lived in villages. They didn't import resources. They didn't require the importation of resources. They would do some, you know, trade, but that wasn't necessary. They ate salmon. They ate elk. They ate huckleberries. They ate clams. They ate sea lions. You know, they ate blackberries. They ate what the land gave them willingly, and they lived here at least 12,500 years. If you believe the myths of science, and if you believe the myths of their culture, they lived here since the beginning of time. And they did that without destroying the land base. And the dominant culture has been here for, about 160 years now. And of course, the place is just getting trashed, and because that's what this culture does. Anyway, so a couple things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One of them is that your way of life can never be sustainable, can never be sustainable, because as soon as you denude the landscape of that particular resource, I mean, if you require the importation of resources, it means you've denuded the landscape of that particular resource, and as your city grows, you'll have to denude an ever larger area. And the other thing it means is that your way of life must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, then if the people in the next watershed over won't trade you for that particular resource, if you require it, you're going to take it. And which means we could all become junior bodhisattvas, and it wouldn't really matter, because the United States military would still have to be huge in order to gain access to our oil that just happens to be underneath other people's land. If you require the importation of that resource, or coffee, you know, it doesn't matter. Cocaine doesn't matter. You know, it's like if you require the importation of that resource, you're going to take it. And what this all boils down to is that any way of life that's based on the any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resource. Well, I'm going to back up one more time and say, several years ago, I was in a riding a car with a friend of mine, George Draffa, with whom I've written a couple books, and I was just making conversation. I said, so George, if you could live at any level of technology you wanted, what would it be? And George was not in a very good mood that day, and he said, Derek, that's a really stupid question, because we can fantasize whatever we want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology that's sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we'll be there again someday, and the only question really is what's left of the world when we get there. And he's right, of course, that it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. So if every year, if your way of life is based on the use of oil, for example, then eventually you're going to run out. And it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that out. And if your way of life is based on the use of steel, eventually you're going to run out. If your way of life is based on, you know, I mean, you can extend that one. And then I would take that a step further and say, if your way of life is based on the hyper-exploitation of renewable resources, your way of life cannot be sustainable. If every year there are fewer salmon returned than the year before, eventually they'll be gone. If every year there are fewer passenger pigeons returned than the year before. I mean, there were so many passenger pigeons when the dominant culture arrived here. There were flocks that darkened the sky for days at a time, and literally. And there were flocks that would number in the billions of birds, and they're all gone. They were killed for food. They're killed for money. And great ox. You know why there's no penguins in the Northern Hemisphere? The reason is because they were exterminated. The great auk. They were called penguins in Portuguese, which means the fat one. And an early French explorer said that they were on islands out in the Atlantic, and there were so many. They were originally in Europe, but of course they were eradicated earlier because the culture was there first. And an explorer said that there were so many on these islands that you could load every ship in France up to bursting, and it wouldn't make a dent on this one little island. Well, they did, and it did. And if every year there are fewer great auks, eventually there won't be any great auks. And I would take it a step further and say that any way of life based on, this goes back to what we were talking about a second ago, any way of life based on the use of resources is not sustainable. And what I mean by that is that, remember what I was saying, if you know, the Canadian lumberman, you look at trees, you see dollar bills. And one more thing about this, and then I'll get off it, that I was doing an interview a few years ago in Spokane, Washington, and the interviewer asked me, you know, he said, you know, Indians exploited salmon too. And I said, no, they didn't. They ate them. He said, well, what's the difference? I said, well, they gave them respect for the spirit in exchange for the flesh. I knew the answer was kind of, you know, was okay as far as it went, but I knew it was also kind of nonsense. But I was, you know, I'm a male, so I was required by law to answer any question anybody asked. And that afternoon, I went out and I sat next to this tree that I had a long relationship with, and I asked the tree, what is the fundamental predator-prey relationship? And the tree gave me the answer immediately, which is, if you consume the flesh of another, you now take responsibility for the continuation of the other's community. And So if I consume the flesh of salmon from the Klamath River, I now take responsibility for the continuation of the Klamath River salmon community. And everybody knows this. I mean, mergansers know that if you eat all the frogs in a pond or eat all the newts in a pond, they're going to be gone. And so I've actually noticed this in a pond near my home, that the mergansers would only come through once every few years to take out to eat some of the newts, and then they know they've got to leave. And this year they were here, I think, 3 years ago, and then this year finally there's a big newt population again, and we'll see if they're back this year or next year. And this is, everybody understands this. It's just we forget. I want to go one more direction here, which is, you know, there's this really stupid notion that natural selection is based on competition, which of course is what you'd expect from people who are traumatized to that belief. But I can disprove that very quickly, which is simply by saying that those creatures who survive in the long run survive in the long run. And you don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings. You actually survive in the long run by making it so your habitat benefits by your presence. I mean, it's pretty obvious. And so one more thing about this, which is that I got in an argument a few years ago with this guy who said that because I use toilet paper, I am just as culpable for deforestation as the CEO of Weyerhaeuser. And it didn't make any sense to me. I thought about it for a long time. And finally I realized, well, I asked a tree about it for one thing, and the tree said, look, you're an animal, you consume things, get over it. And then also, it made clear to me that the reason I am culpable is not because I use toilet paper, but because I don't fulfill my end of the bargain. If I consume the flesh of a tree, I need to take responsibility for the continuation of that other community. So yes, I am culpable. Not because I consume toilet paper, but because I don't stop Weyerhaeuser. That makes me culpable. Okay, so now we finally get to, what was your question?
We wanted to know about strategies and tactics to use as activists. And just a quote from Endgame, what is our solution? Probably the most commonly chosen solution is to use only tactics deemed acceptable to those in power. The main advantage of pursuing this non-option is that you get to feel good about yourself for fighting the good fight against the system of exploitation while not actually putting at risk the benefits you gain from the same system. Have you ever wondered why so many people in North America support rebel groups in the developing world then participate in similarly open revolt here?
Okay, so far as strategy and tactics, yeah, I mean, there's a great line by, I think it's Lucy Parsons, who said, never be deceived that the rich will allow you to vote away their wealth. Somebody asked me, I was doing a film interview the other day, and somebody asked me for a definition, what do I mean when I talk about bringing down civilization? And because that's what we need to do. We need to bring down civilization. I mean, civilization has been killing the planet for 6,000 years. I mean, very, very quick on this is, you know, they say one of the signs of intelligence is the ability to see patterns, to recognize patterns. And I'm going to lay out a pattern here real quick, and let's see if we can recognize it in less than 6,000 years, which is when you think of the hillsides of Iraq and the plains of Iraq, do you normally think about cedar forests so thick that sunlight never reaches the ground? That's the first written myth of this culture, is Gilgamesh going in and cutting down those forests to make cities. When we think about the Arabian Peninsula, do we normally think about oak forests, which it used to be? We go a little bit further west. You know, there's the cedars of Lebanon. They still got one on their flag. That used to be heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. That was cut down to make the Phoenician and Egyptian navies. I never can remember which one it was. Excuse me, whether it was Aristotle or Plato or one of those dead guys complained about how deforestation in Greece was destroying their water quality. And I'm presuming, of course, that that those in power said, "Oh, we need to study this for a few more years before we act on it." Italy was heavily forested. France, England. I mean, there's a great line by somebody: "Forest precedes and deserts dog our heels." I mean, this culture's been doing this. I mean, so what I want to do is. Well, what I want, as I said, is to live in a world with more wild salmon, and what I want to do is strike at the root, is to get rid of this culture that is killing the planet. And somebody asked me the other day what I mean by bringing down civilization, and I've never had a really good answer to that question until then. And the answer that I gave, which is I want to deprive the rich of the ability to steal from the poor, and I want to deprive the rich of the ability to destroy the world. And that really I think that pretty much gets to the heart of it. So far as strategy and tactics, I was talking to my mom the other day, and we were both agreeing that, you know, the whole democracy thing is the biggest, it's one of the biggest cons that's ever been foisted upon the world. This belief. I mean, that's another thing that's pretty funny, is I used to teach at a really conservative university in Eastern Washington University, and I used to just ask my students, so how many of you believe we live in a democracy? And they would just laugh. I mean, the whole thing's a joke, and we all recognize it's a joke, but we keep playing on. And it's the same as true. I mean, I've done so many timber sale appeals, which, by the way, I don't mean to devalue the very important work done by people who do, for example, do timber sale appeals or who work within the system. I think it's really important to work within the system. I think it's very important to use, when I say I'll do whatever it takes, that's not code language for blowing up dams. It's code language for working within the system, too, working within and without the system. It's for doing everything. I was pretty appalled. I was doing a talk a while ago, and actually a pretty big talk, maybe 1,000 people there, and I stopped at one point. I don't know why. It was during Q&A. I stopped, and I said, so I'm just wondering how many people here have ever filed it? And we're all getting really excited about bringing down civilization. Yeah, let's go do something. I said, how many people here have ever filed a timber sale appeal? And there were only two people, myself and one other person, raised our hands. And, you know, there's plenty of other ways people can be active that have nothing to do with timber sale appeals. But it suddenly occurred to me that part of the problem is that there are a lot of people who aren't even working inside the system, much less working outside it. And we need to do it all. We need people to file timber sale appeals. We need people to chain themselves to trees. We need people to go after electrical infrastructures. We need people to take out dams. We need people to do everything. And part of the way to look at this is it's really clear to me that the government, and it doesn't matter which government we're talking about because they're all the same in this way, the government is a government of occupation. The culture is a culture of occupation. And, you know, a lot of my American Indian friends are saying, yeah, what took you so long to figure this one out? And what does a government of occupation do? What a government of occupation does is it moves in, takes resources, and doesn't care about communities. It is set up to facilitate the resource extraction. And what would we all do if space aliens were coming down from outer space and they were systematically vacuuming the oceans and they were systematically deforesting the planet and they were putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk? But we did get tomatoes in January, so that's good. And we got nice computers that we can play games on. And, you know, what would we do if they were systematically changing the climate of the planet? If they were doing all the things that are being done by those in power now, what would we do if space aliens were doing that? What would we do if Chinese communists or Russian commie pinkos or Islamo-fascists or whoever the enemy du jour is, what would we do if they were erecting dams on every river and killing every salmon run, every sturgeon run, every, you know, what would we do if they were killing our land base? I think we all know what we would do. We'd watch television, by gum. I'm not saying, by the way, when I say it's a government occupation, I'm not saying that we shouldn't vote or something. I'm not saying that we shouldn't. I mean, I actually think voting is a big joke. I mean, I would never vote for Republican or Democrat at the national level. Voting, I think, is kind of handy at the local level. I think I voted for Leonard Peltier in the last United States election. Time before that, I think I voted for Emma Goldman. I don't remember who I voted for before. Oh, I voted for Ralph Nader in 2000. And 1996 voted for Ralph Nader, and 1992 I voted for Emma Goldman. The point is that so far as strategy and tactics, we need it all, and we need to recognize that. And what would we do if we were Russian partisans in World War II? Would we appeal to the government? We have to recognize that the government is not there to serve our interests. The government is there to provide the muscle for and to provide a form of semi-legitimacy to the exploitation of the poor by the rich. I mean, that is the fundamental purpose of government. And it's a measure of our the sloppiness of much of our thinking and the level of our indoctrination that we fail to immediately recognize that. And there's another thing actually about this too. A couple things about this. One is that this whole question of identity is really important, which by the way also, I don't mean to say that just because it's a government occupation, all governments of occupation are the same. If I were in Nazi-occupied Europe, I would much rather have been in Nazi-occupied Denmark than Nazi-occupied Poland because the governor was nicer. So given a choice between a nice governor of occupation and a mean governor of occupation, I'll take a nice one. But that doesn't alter the fact that they're both governors of occupation. And this whole question actually runs pretty deep. I mean, the other day a friend of mine called me up. There's a couple levels I want to talk about this. One of them is, the other day, a friend of mine called me up and said, "So, Derek, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq?" I'm like, "We're in Iraq? I thought we were in Northern California." He's like, "You know, Derek, this is why I only call you once every few weeks. How much longer do you think our troops are going to be in Iraq?" And I said, "I got troops? I didn't know I have troops. Can I, like, tell them to go take out a dam and I'll do it?" And the point is that if you identify with the government and its agencies, you're going to be fighting yourself as well as them. And I think that makes things infinitely harder. I don't think that Tecumseh had a problem of figuring out who is us and them. And I think there really is an us and them, and we need to recognize that. And that's one of the big problems is we keep getting our identity all confused with theirs, and that's a very, very big mistake. And the next thing about that is that the identity actually runs deeper than that, though, because if your experience is that your food comes from the grocery store and your water comes from a tap, you will defend to the death the system that brings both of those to you because your life depends on that system. This is not belief. This is experience. If your experience is that your food comes from a land base, and that your water comes from a river. You know, people actually used to drink from rivers. How quaint is that? And if your experience is that your food comes from a land base, you will defend to the death the land base that gives you that food because your life depends on it. So this whole question of identity, we've been sucked into this system that now our lives depend on this system that is killing everything. And that's a really, really bad situation to be in. And now one more thing before we go to the whole question of strategy and tactics, although we've been talking about that all along, of course, is there's this great book by Robert J. Lifton called The Nazi Doctors. And his fundamental question is, how could people who swore a Hippocratic Oath go and work in a death camp? And what he found was that many of the doctors, he's not talking about Mengele or any of them, he's talking about the regular everyday doctors who went in, how could they possibly work there? And the answer was that a lot of them actually did everything within their power to help the Jews and other inmates under their care. It did everything except for question the larger Auschwitz concentration camp mentality. And so if somebody gets sick, they give them an aspirin to lick, or they hide them for a day or two from the selection people, or if they get typhus, then they kill them. They give them an injection of phenol because that will keep the typhus from spreading. And so once again, within the context of the Auschwitz mentality, they're doing everything they can to help the inmates. Of course, except for questioning the larger reality. And if you step outside of that perspective, what they're doing is they're mass murder and genocide. It's horrible. And that really makes me think a lot about environmental activists, because so many of us will do everything we can to save every little scrap of ground that we can, except, of course, for questioning the larger mentality that's killing the planet. And so, you know, we'll act within the system, And it's really important. I need to also say this, that I absolutely disbelieve in the whole reform versus revolution question. That's not a dichotomy. And I really went to understand this when I was teaching creative writing inside Pelican Bay, which is a super maximum security prison. And I recognized every time I walked in, I was participating in the largest, most oppressive gulag system in the planet right now. And at the same time, I mean, so someday, you know, Robert J. Lifton's granddaughter or something would write a book about, you know, the prison system creative writing instructors or something. You know, how could I, who disbelieve in this system, go in and participate? But at the same time, many of my students told me that my classes were the only things that were keeping them sane. And so at that moment, the reform versus revolution question fell apart for me, because we need it all. We need people designing groovy eco-villages. We need people doing other stuff. We need people getting out to vote, for crying out loud. We need people doing everything. Things are so dire. And so now the question of strategy and tactics, and we can talk more about it too, but to finish my little rant here, my tirade, I guess the guy at Sierra Club would say, is that people ask me all the time, so what should I do? And I always say, don't ask me. I don't live there. I don't live where you live. I don't know how to live sustainably. If you want to know what to do, go to the nearest river and ask that river what it wants. And go to the nearest forest and ask the forest what it wants. And go ask anyone who has lived there for thousands, and in the case of rivers, you know, sometimes millions of years. Go ask them what they want. Go ask them how you can help them, how you can serve them. And they'll give you the answers. And so when people, you know, once again, what do we need to do for strategy and tactics? My first answer is listen to the natural world. Ask it what it wants and really be ready for the answer.
My next question for you, Derek, to kind of continue on this topic, is, and I'll throw it at some questions you ask in Endgame, actually, which are, what are some of civilization's bottlenecks? What are some of its limiting factors, the objects or processes that, if interdicted, could cause civilization to grind to a halt? Similarly, where can we find the fulcrums to magnify our efforts? Where do we put the levers? What do we use for fulcrums? And how and when and how hard do we push to help topple this culture of death? What are some of your answers to those questions, to continue on this topic of strategies and tactics and whatnot?
Well, I just want to say, first off, I think the questions you're asking are really great. Thank you for asking these questions. And, you know, if we're going to think about fighting this culture, we really do need to think about leverage, because we don't have the numbers of humans right now. Well, we don't have the numbers of rich humans. I mean, if you go all around the world, I believe about half the humans in the world, I could be wrong on this, but I believe about half the humans in the world are not part of the global economic system. A lot of them have never had a cash exchange, subsistence farmers, indigenous people. It's really easy to forget here in the industrialized world that there are a lot of people who don't participate in these systems, and of course, who would be better off without the systems immediately. I asked the really good activist Anuradha Mittal, former director of Food First, if the people of India would be better off if the U.S. economy disappeared tomorrow. And she said, of course. She started laughing. An example she gave that has to do with Europe but still applies is that there are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. And so there are people starving to death in India so that people in Europe can have dog food and tulips, and people being forced off their land. And it's the same, of course, with coffee or anything else. You know, we don't really need to go into that. But all those people would be better off immediately if the U.S. economy ground to a halt. And but within the industrialized world, we don't have the numbers and the pure force. And which, by the way, is an argument that's often thrown out by pacifists. It's like, look, they have the ability to wage war much better than we do, which means we can never use that tactic. And that's absolutely absurd, because if you go by that, they also have the ability to wage discourse much better. They control the mass media. So if you're going to say we shouldn't fight back using that because they outnumber us, then that means we shouldn't talk either, I guess. And because they have the ability to raise a lot of money, that means we shouldn't use money. I mean, so that doesn't work. what it means is that we need to think about leverage. And we need to think about how we can leverage our efforts. And levers, if you recall from teeter totters, are, you know, if you have a long lever arm, you can make it so the force that you exert moves a much bigger object at the other end. And so voting, that's why, you know, I don't say that. But voting is a really interesting example because it's a really, really small lever. I mean, yes, do your bit, go vote. But it's a teensy, teensy little lever, presuming that the votes are even counted. And people say then, vote with your dollars, you know, boycott. And, well, that's a really, really small lever, too. I'm not saying we shouldn't use them. I'm just saying they're really, really small levers. I figured this out. I fly a lot to do my talks. And because I live in a small community, United is the only airline that comes in here. And so I actually figured out how much of their revenue I was responsible for. I it was like a couple years ago. And I think it was, and I'm making the number up here, I don't remember what it was, but it was like I was responsible for one out of every $9 billion or something. I don't know. So it was some really small amount. And so I could boycott. And well, that would be a lever of 1/9 billionth. You know, it's a really, really tiny lever. And then, of course, people will say, well, gosh, you know, what if everybody did? You could get everybody to boycott. And it's like, well, shoot, if I'm going to fantasize about everybody to boycott, why don't I fantasize about, you know, getting everybody to rise up and do a bunch of other things? If, you know, if we're going to fantasize, let's fantasize big. Okay, so then let's think about leverage. And, okay, I'm going to talk. I want to be really explicit here, especially given the whole climate. The whole political climate, that I am not talking about assassinating political figures in the United States or Canada. I am absolutely not talking about that. I want to give an example of leverage from World War II that would have been a huge lever arm. One man by himself almost stopped World War II in its tracks. His name is George Elser. Who? George Elser was a guy who decided he was going to kill Hitler because he didn't like how Hitler was treating the trade unions, among other reasons. And so he meticulously he worked for a he went to work for a mining company so that he could steal some explosives, and then after that he moved to Munich where every year Hitler would give a speech, and then he would sneak into this restaurant, hide there where the speech was given every year, and he would hide there until it was closed, and they would come out, and every night he would remove this one panel and then meticulously chip away at the pillar behind it until he had a space big enough to hold his bomb. And then he put it back, and he set a timer. Every year Hitler gave a speech from 8:30 to 9:30. He set the timer for, I think, 10 after 9. But that year, because of weather, and because of train schedules, Hitler gave a speech from 8 to 9, I believe it was, and left the room, and then the bomb went off at 10 after. And all the members of the German resistance all through said that the key to stopping the Nazi regime was killing Hitler. And so my point once again, I'm not saying we should all send bags of pretzels to George Bush or anything. I'm not saying that. So, you know, all you Fed agents out there can go ahead and just lose your erections. What I'm saying is in that particular case, that was a really, really long lever. And so what I would like for people to do is think about the ways they can leverage their efforts. And one of the ways to think about leverage is to think also about bottlenecks and to think where are the, or as they're called in the U.S. military, choke points. And a bottleneck is simply, you know, you're driving down the interstate and then two lanes of traffic are shut down because of, you know, an accident on the right and an accident on the left. We got ourselves a classic bottleneck. What are some of the bottlenecks that make this whole system move forward? Another really good example from World War II is industrial diamonds. The whole Nazi industrial complex would have collapsed within 6 months if industrial diamonds had not continued to flow into the country with the connivance of De Beers, by the way, from the South African nations. They were smuggled in Red Cross packages. And so that's a really strong bottleneck is industrial diamonds there. The transportation system in Germany was a big bottleneck. At first, they were just sort of bombing random factories, and then they decided to focus on a ball bearing plant, because if you bomb a tractor plant, then they can't make engines for their tanks. But if you bomb the ball bearing plant, they can't remake the factory, because ball bearings are needed for the factory. And that helped some, but then somebody else had this other idea, why don't we just bomb the transportation system? It's the weakest link. And they did that, and that had more effect on the German industrial economy than any of the other bombings that they did. That was what really crippled. And so, once again, I can't speak to different locales, but that's one of the things, though, is it's not locales, it's a larger system. I mean, that's something to just think about, is what are the bottlenecks, personal? I mean, and this doesn't mean simply, you know, going and blowing stuff up. What this also is like, these are true in relationships, too. You know, what are the bottlenecks in relationships that you either want to, within a personal relationship that you want to expand and you want to have flourish, you might want to try to see what you can do about that bottleneck, either to make the person feel comfortable with it or to help them get rid of it if necessary, whatever. And, you know, what are our social bottlenecks? And I think it's really incumbent upon, I mean, okay, here's a bottleneck that I read about on the internet the other day. It's pretty interesting. I don't remember what they're called. They are, this isn't actually in the book because I just heard about this the other day. Somebody sent me some email. I thought it was pretty interesting. But it ends up that the way, you know, if somebody goes to www.blahblahblah.org, then what they're actually doing is they send out a request to a place that's basically like a routing system, has a big phone book there that says that the, you know, www.blahblahblah.org is on some guy's server in the middle of western Kansas, you know, in his backyard or whatever, you know, in his basement, whatever. Or, you know, maybe it's in, I mean, the information is actually held in physical places. But the problem is finding the addresses, and there's only like three or four of those in the country, I believe. And, I mean, that's a huge and actually, frankly, pretty stupid bottleneck. I think I read something, and I could be getting confused on this because I didn't understand all the technical stuff, but I think that the Europeans were getting really upset at that the other day, because what it does is it allows, since they're in the United States, it allows the United States to control basically all the internet traffic. That, by the way, I was talking to some hackers, and that's one of the reasons, by the way, that so many hackers are very, very political, and so many of them attack Microsoft, is because what they're attempting to do is show how stupid it is to allow one corporation to control global communications. And that's why they keep hitting it again and again and again, is to say, look, this is a bottleneck. And a lot of them aren't actually attempting to destroy the system. A lot of them are attempting to point out the stupidity of that particular bottleneck. Microsoft is a huge bottleneck, which, you know, once again, hackers recognize everywhere. That's all for now, I guess.
Thanks for that, Derek. But if we could come back to the idea of our culture being in an abusive relationship, I find that quite often, as activists, we take the victim mentality and really see ourselves as a victim of this culture. Can you speak about how we could think of ourselves as survivors of this culture?
Yeah, it's a great question. I have to think for a second. Can you ask that question again slightly differently?
I work in the violence against women sector.
Uh-huh.
And I find that working with second wave feminists in an organization that's been around for 30 years,
uh-huh,
I'll quite often run into women who will say, no, we shouldn't ask for that because we're victims. We, for whatever reason, we might not deserve it, we might not get it. And what, in that specific organization and in my work as an activist, I'm thinking of ways that we can really stop viewing ourselves as victims and start viewing ourselves as powerful, strong survivors.
Right, okay. That actually leads to a discussion of hope, I think, which is one of my favorite things to bash. First, I think that before we see ourselves as not victims, but as survivors, I think first we do have to see ourselves as victims, because I think a lot of people are walking around not recognizing that they are victims. You know, we can, it's, you know, in terms of battered women, it's like, well, you know, he just, I'm not a victim of domestic violence. He just gets a little upset, and, you know, it's my fault. And, I mean, so I really did bring it on. And so that person, I think, first has to go through a stage of recognizing, yes, I am being victimized by an exploiter. And we can see how that relates on the larger scale, too, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and don't worry, I'm not going to stop us there. But my point is that we have to recognize that the system is exploiting us and exploiting everyone around us. We have to recognize we are victims first. You can't stop there, because victims are fundamentally powerless. And the next step is to make a decision as to whether you want to be a victim or not. And well, actually, before that, you have to recognize that your victimhood is not inevitable, that there are other things you can do, that there are alternatives. Because that's one of the things that an abuser always does. One of the first things that an abuser does is monopolize the victim's perception. Because if you can monopolize the other person's perception, that's why so many abusers will destroy all the other relationships in a person's life, is because if the person has any inkling that there are other ways to be, if there's any inkling that escape is really possible, then the perpetrator will never be able to turn the person into a real victim, because a victim really is someone who, I mean, a victim when it's totally internalized is someone who no longer sees a way out. And so when I was saying a person has to recognize they're a victim, I'm being a little bit sloppy, because, okay, here's what I want to say. Instead of recognizing they are a victim, I should say the first thing is that they have to recognize they're being victimized. So are you more comfortable with that?
Mm-hmm. Or recognize the oppression that they're living under.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. And then once you recognize, but that's an inevitable first step, because if you don't recognize that you're living under oppression, then why would you want to escape anyway?
Mm-hmm.
And so the first thing is to recognize you are being oppressed. And then the second thing is to recognize that there is a way, that there are ways out. And the perps will do anything they can to attempt to make that unthinkable. And so one of the first things we need to do is to recognize the possibilities of difference. I mean, in terms of a larger question, not every culture has killed the planet. That's, you know, it's not every, I mean, this is not a human problem. Not every human culture has acted this way. There were humans, as I said, living here for at least 12,500 years. And we can say the same thing for many, many, many different places. Humans have lived, I mean, the San Bushmen of who are now being eradicated, they evolved in place. I mean, they and their evolutionary predecessors lived there for like 3.5 million years, or for a couple million years. It's that is sustainable. And so we have to recognize first that other ways of living are possible, and second, we have to recognize that it's possible for us to defeat this culture. I read this horrible quote the other day by one of those sort of live simply gurus, who said that basically we're at a place now where the Indians were in the late 19th century, where we have to recognize we can't win, and so we simply have to remember what it means to be human. And that made me so furious, because it's classic victim thinking. It's like, well, if I'm going to walk into the gas chambers, at least I can, you know, sort of hold my head up high as I do it, and that'll show them. It's like, that's nonsense, and that's horrible. And part of what we need to recognize is that we do actually have some power, and that we are able to affect change. And one of the things that we need to do for that is one of the smartest things that the Nazis did was to make it so that at every step of the way, it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. And we can say the same thing. Oh, I'm going to stop and go a different direction for a second because this all ties back in. And, you know, I've been advocating dam removal for years, and there are 60,000 dams in this country, in the United States, over 70,000 dams, I think, over 6 feet tall, 60,000 dams over 20 feet tall, and about 2 million dams total. And, yeah, dams being removed, but very, very slowly. And if we removed one dam per day, it would still take 200 years for us to take out all of the dams over 6 feet tall. And, you know, salmon and sturgeon don't have that long. And so I was – one of the arguments that's been used against taking out dams by some people is to say, you know, if you just take out a dam without, you know, going through all the proper channels, you cause more harm to the river than leaving the dam there. And I didn't know if that was true, so I called some fisheries biologists. And it was pretty funny because I'd call up and say, hey, so if somebody takes out a dam, does that hurt the river? It's like, hello? Hello? You know, they wouldn't answer, of course, for obvious reasons. And so I said, well let's change the framing a little bit and say, you know, this culture has collapsed and no longer are the dams useful for economic purposes, blah, blah, blah. So people in your community ask you, is it better to let the dam wait until it fails or to take it out now? And they all then were happy to answer. And they also did basically the same thing, which is that, first, dams occur naturally. And this is going to come back. Don't worry, it'll apply. Dams occur naturally. And what doesn't occur naturally is for all the rivers to be dammed like this. But they do happen, you know, with mudslides or lava flows or ice jams or whatever. And then they break. And when they break, it's basically just a big flood. And rivers are not, we misunderstand rivers entirely, that rivers are not the things between the banks. Rivers, if you look at them over their lifetime, they writhe like snakes all over the landscape. They move everywhere. And all of that area is part of the river. And if every time a river changes course, it, and here's the point, every time a river changes course, every time there's a flood, that's, you know, it kills, you know, millions of insects and salamanders and frogs and fish and everything. But it causes short-term habitat loss, long-term habitat gain. That's what happens every time. And when somebody said that to me, it gave me chills. And the reason is, why do we stay in abusive relationships? Because we're afraid of short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. Why do we stay in jobs we hate? We're afraid of the short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. Why don't we bring down this culture? We're afraid of the short-term habitat loss for the long-term habitat gain. Why do we remain victims? We're afraid of short-term habitat loss for long-term habitat gain. It's central. It's absolutely central to everything. Now back to the Nazis. One of the smartest things the Nazis did was they co-opted rationality and co-opted hope by making it so that at every step of the way it was in the Jews' rational best interest to not resist. Would you rather get an ID card or would you rather resist and possibly get killed? There's that short-term habitat loss. If I fight this, short-term habitat loss, long-term habitat gain. Would you rather move to a ghetto? Would you rather resist and possibly get killed? You want to get on a cattle car? You want to resist and possibly get killed? You want to go into the showers? You want to resist and possibly get killed? But something very interesting is that the Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a much higher rate of survival than those who went along. I'll say that again. The Jews who participated in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising had a much higher rate of survival than those who went along. And so if we can get past that, actually I want to talk about hope now very briefly, which is that years ago a friend of mine who's HIV positive sent me a bunch of literature on AIDS, and there was this one AIDS, and there was this one line that just slapped me in the face, which was eliminate false hope. And it seemed really crucial to me that that's one of the central things we have to do, is to eliminate false hope. What was it? I mean, one of the reasons my mother stayed with my father, who's incredibly violent, was because there weren't battered women shelters in the 50s and 60s. But another reason she stayed with him is because of the false hope that he would change. And does anybody really believe that Weyerhaeuser is going to stop deforesting because we asked nicely? Does anybody really believe that if we can just get a Democrat in the White House, things will be okay? Or that Monsanto will stop Monsantoing because we asked nicely? Those are all false hopes that keep us tied to the system. So we need to get rid of those. But it's not just false hope, it's hope itself. I was bashing hope at a talk I did a couple years ago, and someone in the audience shouted out, "So what do you mean by hope? What's your definition?" And I didn't have one, so I asked them to define it, and they came up with a definition that was really good, which is hope is a longing for a future condition over which you have no agency. So if I'm in an abusive relationship and I hope that I don't get beaten, that's, well, and I shouldn't say that actually, because the truth is, it's back to the Nazi doctors thing, that women in abusive relationships oftentimes show tremendous, tremendous agency and ingenuity and brilliance in attempting to navigate that relationship without questioning the larger concentration camp Auschwitz abusive reality. So they can send the children over to the neighbors when they know that the father's going to get really abusive. Or they can use sex to placate him to keep him from hitting them. Or they can, you know, do this or do that. They can be incredibly resourceful, but without questioning that larger picture. But so far as the larger picture, and by the way, I don't want to blame the victims for not leaving too, or blame the women for not leaving, which they would still be victims if they don't leave, but I don't want to blame them for not leaving too, because we all know the statistics on that, that the average woman who finally leaves an abuser has already tried to leave like 7 times, and we all know the statistics on the women who get killed when they try to leave and all that. I'm not saying they should stay. I'm just saying I'm not attacking them for not leaving. That's why I want to be really clear on that. But anyway, back to the hope thing, is that hope is a longing for a future condition over which I have no agency. So if I say, I hope that things improve, I'm saying I have no agency. If I say, I hope that salmon don't go extinct, I'm saying I have no agency. On the other hand, I'm not going to say, I hope I eat today. I'm just going to do it, you know? And it's the same. I don't hope that coho salmon survive and that Chinook salmon survive. I will do whatever it takes to make sure they survive. Salmon will not go extinct in my lifetime because I won't allow it. I will do whatever it takes to make sure they survive. And that's an incredibly different statement. That is a statement of a survivor. That is a statement of an actor, of someone who is being active. That's not the statement of a victim. And so one of the things I think is really important is to get to the state where a person says, I will do whatever it takes to stop this oppression. And that's not a process that happens over 5 minutes. I mean, you can say it, and then the next time you get beaten down, it's like, you know, and you can still respond the same way. I mean, I still fall back into old patterns, too. I mean, we need to really be forgiving of ourselves in that. I mean, it's not some magical pill that you take and suddenly you're invincible. But it's recognizing that once you give up on that identity as someone who relies on the abuser, once you realize that you don't need to rely on them and that you can fight back, something shifts dramatically.
So one person asks you, Derek, what keeps you fighting for change? How do you keep yourself from breaking down given all the horrifying realities of civilization? How do you think we can make our struggles more sustainable?
Oh, I break down all the time. I cry a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're not going to cry about the salmon, you know, what is there that's worth crying about? And, but I don't get burned out. I don't get burned out at all. And one of the reasons, that's part of it too, is there's a lot of times this belief that if we really recognize how bad things are, that we have to be, unhappy all the time. And the truth is, I'm really, really happy. I'm so in love with my life, and I'm so in love with life in general. We're all complex enough beings that we can hold in our hearts the understanding of how bad things are, and that life is really, really good. Life is so wonderful. I'm looking out the window here at these beautiful redwood trees, and life is just so wonderful. And that's one of the things that keeps me going. And there was a two-part question. What was the first part again?
What keeps you fighting for change?
Well, and that, because I'm in love, you know? I got this email from this guy in Washington a few years ago who said that he didn't know. He said his son's 15 years old and is really active and all, you know, great and everything, and he's really concerned because he doesn't know how to he wants his son to keep fighting these fights, but he doesn't know how to give him hope. And I wrote back and said, if you want your son to keep fighting, don't give him hope, give him love. Because if he loves, he'll keep fighting, you know? If you're in love, you act to defend your beloved. There's this strange notion somehow that that love somehow, I mean, that the pacifists have sort of co-opted love, and that's just nonsense. I don't think that Mother Grizzly Bears would agree that if you love, you're a pacifist. You know, I grew up in the country, and in my life, I've been attacked by mother chickens, geese, ducks, horses, cows, mice, hummingbirds, hawks, eagles, spiders, who thought I was attacking their babies. And, you know, if a mother mouse is going to take on someone 6,000 times her size to defend those she loves, you know, what's wrong with us? So that's one of the things that keeps me going. There's a tremendous, also, I don't try to fight the rage or the sorrow. I simply feel them. I am so full of rage, and I'm so full of love, and I'm so full of hate, and I'm so full of sorrow and joy and all those things. And it takes more energy to try to fight them down, to think they're bad, than it does to actually feel them and act on them. And they're wonderful things. I mean, if you're not going to get outraged at, I love the word outrage, you know, rage out, you know? And if you're not going to get outraged at the killing of the planet, you know, what is it going to take? It's so, oh, I want to say one more thing about burnout, too, which is, you know, a lot of activists, I've known a lot of activists who've gotten burned out, and I think part of the reason is because we keep doing the same thing over and over again, and it keeps not working. And I think burnout is actually a really good piece of information because it's telling you this isn't working, so try something else. It's not telling you quit because so many people, oh, God, I'm so burned out. I need to take a couple weeks off. And then they take a couple weeks off, and they come back, and they do the same stinking thing over again. And it's like, well, no wonder. And but it might be, well, it's time to change some tactics and to figure out what will work and to try to just think clearly. What is it you want? Like I said, you know, I want more wild salmon. I mean, make that, you know, we can say the same thing. I have a good friend who runs the Bad Women's Program for the state of New York, Charlotte Watson, and she's very clear on what she wants. She wants to live in a world where men don't beat on women. And, you know, so it doesn't matter whether you choose salmon or men beat on women or Ward Churchill has said he's really clear on what he wants. He wants a world where the dominant culture is not killing Indian children. And I was sharing the stage with him, and I was saying, you know, salmon children, he was saying Indian children, and we're like, yeah, it's the same battle. It doesn't matter. And so, you know, find out what you want and figure out how am I going to get there. And then just go for it. Just do it.
I got another question here. Uh-huh. I really like that answer, by the way.
Thank you.
Very moving, for sure. What do you think about this? And there are kind of some crossovers here, but what do you think of finding a balance between destroying the systems of oppressive power and building the world we want to see? I guess we talked about this a bit in strategies and tactics, and we'd cover this a little bit, but I wonder if you have anything more to say about that.
well, you know me, but I do.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a couple things about that. One is I do get dinged a fair amount for not presenting, you know, positive alternatives. And one reason I don't is because the Indians already did, and the indigenous peoples the world over already have. And we don't need to – I mean, sure, we can – I mean, every cell in my body wants for us to have some sort of soft landing. And so, you know, the people that are doing work on renewables and sustainable communities and all that, I think it's really important work. With a couple caveats. One is, once again, you know, the Indians already did that, but that doesn't, you know, we can still try to help figure out how the landing could be softer. Great, that's really important. But at the same time, okay, years ago I did this, I was at this sort of conference deal, and there were like 20 of these longtime activists, 25 or 30 or something. And one of the questions they asked is they said, okay, pretend it's 20 years from now and we've all, you know, we've somehow had this miraculous transformation. We're living sustainably. What would that look like, smell like, blah, blah, blah. And everybody's giving all their answers. And it made me just furious. And I said, this is really painful for me. And one reason is because, A, you haven't talked about the transition, which is going to be painful. And two, or B or whatever, if we develop this sustainable community within the larger destructive context, and those in power discover resources on our land that they want, we all know what happens to our community, to the resources, and to us as individuals if we resist. And so it's like being, once again, in an abusive relationship and trying to figure out how you can make a little sanctuary within that abusive relationship. Because the dominant culture is insatiable, and it's driven by a death urge. And we, if no matter what good things we develop, it will continue. It doesn't matter if you have this wonderful eco-village on a planet that's entirely toxified. We need to stop that at its root, which is not to say everyone needs to be doing that work, because there, I mean, this is just my proclivity. And if someone has a gift for working in that direction, I mean, it's like if somebody's gift is to build straw bale houses, it's like, we need it. We so need it. And if somebody's gift is to, you know, work on peaceful conflict resolution, go for it. I mean, I'm so inclusive on tactics as long as the other people are inclusive of tactics that they don't particularly choose. And so I think it's all so necessary. It's all absolutely necessary. But, and what's forgotten in that quite often is that we need to stop the system that is destroying the world. And that will necessarily involve destructive work.
Thank you, Derek. We have another, it's less of a question, more of a statement from someone who called in. And they've been thinking a lot about the emotional sustainability of political struggle and resistance. And as a person of relative privilege, they're feeling exhausted and losing hope as we endlessly seem to be cleaning up the messes of capitalism. And they were wondering if you could speak on that, the hopelessness that we feel.
That's great. I think hopelessness is wonderful. Because, as I was saying, you know, with the whole, I think hope is a really problematical thing. Because it's it's an acknowledgement that you have no agency. And what I'm really interested in is agency. And I don't have a problem, by the way, with being a person of privilege and using that privilege, because it is my responsibility. I can say things. I mean, I've had after I wrote Culture Make Believe, which is partly about race issues too, this African-American guy came up to me and said, you know, you're saying a lot of things that people will listen to because you're white, and I can't say them because I'm black. If I say them, I'm just this angry black man. And I said, great. You know, I have been given, because of my skin color and because of my, my chromosomes, because I have testicles, I've been given certain privileges because I've been privileged enough to know how to read. And it is my responsibility to use those privileges to undercut their very basis. So that's a really important thing. And so far as the hopelessness, I think when I recognized that, when I recognized that, you know, we aren't going to make it to some great new glorious tomorrow, and that the dominant culture, unless it stops, is going to kill everything on the planet, that was both a tremendously sorrowful point, and it was also I guess very quickly I want to tell that story I started to tell before we got cut off, which was that a few years ago, I got a call from a friend of mine who said, she's an activist, who said, you know, this doing this activism is just breaking my heart. It's just killing me. I said, yeah, I'll do that. And then she said, you know, the dominant culture just hates everything, doesn't it? I said, yeah, it does. And then she said, it's driven by a death urge, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is. And she said, unless it stops, it's going to kill everything on the planet, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is. And then she said, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And I said the best thing I could possibly say, which was, I've been waiting for you to say that. And the reason that was the best thing I could say is because about 12 years ago now, I was undergoing a similar collapse. I was just bursting into tears all the time and just sobs and sobs. And a lot of my environmental activist friends of mine were saying, you know, just take some time off, you know, think the problems will be here when you come back. And I knew I couldn't do that. And in the midst of that, I called this friend of mine, Jeanette Armstrong, Okanagan, Indian, and activist and writer, and I said basically those same questions. You know, it's like, this is just killing me. This work is so hard. Yeah, it is. You know, unless it stops, the dominant culture is going to kill everything on the planet. Yeah, it is. It's driven by death urge, yeah. And then I said, you know, we're not going to make it some great new glorious tomorrow, are we? And she said, I've been waiting for you to say that. And that was a wonderful thing for her to say. It was the best thing she could possibly say, because what it did is it normalized my despair and let me know that despair is an appropriate response to a desperate situation. And it let me know that I could feel this, all this sorrow and all this pain without it killing me. And even better, that I could feel all this sorrow and this pain and it would kill me. And there's a wonderful thing about being dead, which is once you're dead, they can't touch you anymore. You can still sing and you can still dance and you can still make love and you can still fight like hell, but they can't touch you. The logic of the Nazis, you know, of if you do this, then, I mean, of co-opting rationality no longer works. And so once that you dies, the victim you is dead. And who is alive? And the socially molded you is dead. And who still remains is animal you, who is capable of saying yes and capable of saying no, and is capable of loving and hating. And so one of the reasons I'm so big on bashing hope is because I want to get rid of all of those externally imposed hopes. Because then when you see a weed coming through the sidewalk, and when you see tree roots, you know, ripping up the asphalt, then you can know, yes, this is real. Because when you see something that's positive, once you're dead that way, once you've given up on the system, then you can start to see. See, that's part of the deal, is these false hopes bind us to unlivable situations and they blind us to real possibilities. And once you've just ruthlessly eradicated those false hopes, when you do see positive things, you can know, you can have a better idea that they come from you and from the planet, not from the culture, not from the oppressive system. And so what I would say to somebody who's fighting that despair is, if you have it's really, really, really important to have a strong support system. If you're all by yourself, then all bets are off on this. But if you have a strong support system around you, I mean, because it's like I say, you know, I don't want to have to revisit Civilization is Bad 101 every time I open my mouth. I don't really have any friends who don't recognize how bad things are and who aren't trying to do something about it. And so if you have that supportive system around you, it's okay to collapse because it won't kill you and you'll come out on the other side. I mean, the central metaphor of this entire planet is death and rebirth. You know, we all die and are reborn. And one of the things that has to happen for us to be effectively resist is that victim has to die and the socially molded us has to die so that this other being can be born. Does that make sense?
Makes sense to me. Also, I see you saying there that our society is really afraid of sadness. And yeah, I feel that by being sad, that can also be really amazing too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Being sad over things that really make you sad. I mean, how strange is that? And being happy over the things that make you happy.
I have a question for you from Rade, who's been really generously answering the phones and writing down the questions for us today.
Uh-huh.
And he asks, do the notions of economy and economics inherently alienate us from our surroundings?
Do the notions of economy and economics inherently alienate us?
Mm-hmm.
I think that we can say that definitely within a capitalist system. I'm hesitating because, I mean, I've had lots of discussions with John Zerzan, I mean, whose work, of course, I respect tremendously, about the whole question of how deeply numbers alienate us. And, I mean, I recognize that as soon as I say there are 10 cats, I'm no longer perceiving those cats as individuals. And so on that level, I think that economics and mathematics is inherently alienating. And that doesn't alter the fact that I think that within, and I could change my mind on this, but it doesn't alter the fact that within I mean, just like any tool can alienate you from the object you're using that tool around. I mean, if I dig with a shovel, that I'm sort of alienated from the experience of scrabbling my hands through the dirt, And it's a question of what you want. If I want to, you know, if I want to dig in the dirt, if I want to have a hole, then a shovel is going to be more handy than a hand. But if I want to feel the experience of what the dirt feels like on my hand, then obviously the shovel will alienate me. And I think the same thing is certainly true for intellectual tools, which would include economics, I want to be really clear. On the large scale, of course, it absolutely does nothing but alienate people. On the large scale economics is evil. I'm just saying you and I have a discussion of, you know, we're going to make an exchange where you give me it's not a theoretical example, you know. I took my mom out to lunch the other day, and partly that's, well, let's say it's not really economics though, because that's building relationship. Because, I mean, usually if we eat together, she usually provides the food. And so I thought it was actually good for building relationship to actually provide the food once in a while. And my point is that I guess that takes it out of economics, because if I'm thinking of this as a simple exchange, I will take you to lunch today and you will, you know, cook me some food tomorrow, then that's a different thing than if I'm doing it in the spirit of relationship. Does any of that make any sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. One more question for you. We got about 10 or maybe 8 or 9 or 10 minutes.
Okay.
I wanted to ask you about something that's been on a lot of people's minds lately, and that is this transition or this shift that we're obviously in right now, and regarding climate collapse and peak oil and all this kind of stuff. And I'm just curious what your perspective is about this transition we're entering, keeping in mind those in power's very tight grip and the police state and the military might and all of that. What kind of things do you foresee for yourself and for this general culture? I guess what's going on with this transition?
Well, I'll tell you the thing that scares me the most. The two things that scare me the most, probably second most, is global warming. That really, really scares me a lot. And the second thing, I guess that's the second thing. The first thing that scares me is that those in power will do anything to maintain their power, and they will do anything to not let their perceived control slip. And I have absolutely no doubt that those in power would blow up the world before they would allow their power to be diminished. And so the thing that scares me more than anything is, I mean, it's what Hitler tried to do with Germany. When the war was lost, he was going to destroy Germany. And those are two jokers in the deck that I don't know what to do with. And so those scare me a lot. And apart from that, you know, setting those aside, because that's one of the things we really, really, really need to recognize, is that this is a psychopathological system, and those in power are individually and certainly collectively psychopaths. And by which I mean that they have no conscience, they have no compassion, they have no, and they have this strong need to destroy. I mean, I go through, as you know, in Endgame, I go through and I take the common characteristics listed for psychopaths, and I show one-to-one correspondence with the actions of this culture. And so, I mean, that's part of the transition that scares me. And so, I mean, I don't know what to do about the nukes thing. I mean, a lot of other stuff. I think we can hack away at the system, hack away at oil, and hack away at you know, whatever the supports are for the system. And we need to recognize, by the way, that it's going to be that those in power are ruthless. And if we leave our comfort zone, or I should say if we force them out of their comfort zone, which means that we leave our comfort zone, they will fight back. There's a great line by John Stockwell, who's a former CIA agent who came out against the agency. During a talk he gave, somebody once asked, "Why aren't you dead?" And, you know, if everything you say is true, why haven't they killed you? And his answer was really elegant, which is because they're winning. And as soon as that power slips, which is one of the reasons for the increased repression right now, but the more that the power, the hold of those in power becomes tenuous, the more repressive they will get. And of course, that repression is already happening. Ask the people who are already in prison. But it will become worse. And I mean, I don't mean to get maudlin or anything, but I don't actually think I'm going to survive the transition, because I think this is true. Well, partly because of the Crohn's disease, but also, I mean, basically, as soon as things get really bad, as soon as things start to get really good, anybody who opposes them is dead. And it's like, why were there so many more lynchings after the American Civil War than before? And that's because so long as, there's a great line by Nietzsche, one does not hate when one can despise. And so long as their power, so long as their perceived entitlement isn't threatened, they don't have to kill us. But once that perceived entitlement is threatened, they will not scruple at anything. And I think we just need to recognize that and then move on and do what's right anyway. I keep wondering why the planet hasn't thrown out some disease that's just killed us all. I keep wondering what it's waiting for. And finally, in a book that I just finished not very long ago, just finished writing, I received an answer. And the answer is that, or one of the answers, is that the planet is still trying to figure out if humans are redeemable. And are you going to clean up your own mess, or am I going to clean it up for you? And we're being given a wonderful, wonderful opportunity to show that humans really are redeemable, and we can, and stopping this on our own. And if we don't do it, the planet will. And it's kind of like the old thing about, I don't know if your parents ever said this to you, but I remember when I was a kid, once my mom said to me, you know, you need to clean up your room, and I didn't do it. And she kept saying it, and finally said, look, you have a choice. Either you clean up your room, or I'm going to clean it up. And if I clean it up, you're not going to like it, because I'm throwing everything away. And that's, I believe that we're at a stage now where the planet is saying that to us. It's like, look, clean it up. If you don't do it, I'm going to, and you're not going to like it.
We have about 4 more minutes, 3 or 4 minutes, Derek, if you want to maybe finish off.
So we should end on a happy note.
We should. It's up to you, yeah.
Sorry.
No problem. If you want to take it anywhere you'd like for the next 3 minutes, that'd be great.
Well, normally I end my talks, there's a really happy section I end my talks with, and this is a happy section.
Okay.
Pretend you're a river. Pretend you're the mist who falls so fine, so gentle, that nothing separates water and air. You're the rain who falls in sheets, explodes onto the ground to leave pocks and puddles. You're the ground who receives this water, soaking it up, taking it in, carrying it deep inside. You're the cracks and fissures where the waters accumulate, flow, fall to join more water, and more in pools and rivers who move slowly through cavities, crevices, pores. You're the sounds and silence of water seeping or staying still. You're the meeting of wet and dry, the union of liquid and solid, where solids dissolve and liquids solidify. You're the pressure who pushes water through seams. You're the rushing water who bubbles from the earth. You're a tiny pool between rocks. You overflow, find your way to join others who, like you, are moving, moving. You're the air at the surface of the water, the joining of substantial and insubstantial, the union of under and over, weight and not weight. You are the riffle, the rapid, the tiny waterfall that turns water to air and air to water. You are the mist who settles on the soil. You are the plants who drink the mist, and you are the sun who warms and feeds them. You are the fish who feed on insects, who feed on plants, who feed on soils, who feed on fish. You're the fish who become soils, who become plants, who become insects, who become fish, who float on the river. You are the river who joins other rivers to become a new river who is all the rivers and something else. You're the river. You do not stop at the banks where liquid turns to solid. You reach into the sky and into the soil. Water moves through rocks, comes up to form pools far from the fast flow where the rivers move together, seeps down to join still waters deep below the surface, waters who sleep and wake and sleep and mingle with the stones who are the river too. You are the river, who's married to the mountains you've known since they were young, who've given themselves to you as you've given yourself to them. You are the canyons you nestle into each year deeper than the year before. You are the forests who give you their fallen trees and the meadows you flood and feed and who feed you back their fruits and fine insects who fly to your surface to be taken in by the fish who with their own bodies again feed the meadows. You are the river who feeds the ocean, who feels the tides pushing and pulling against your mouth, the waves mixing fresh and salt. You are that intermingling. That's who you are. That's who you've always been. You are the river. You've lived with volcanoes and glaciers. You've been dammed by lava and ice. You carried log jams so large and so old they grow their own forests with you running beneath. You've lived through droughts and floods. You are the river. You miss the salmon. You miss the sturgeon. You miss the ocean. You miss the meadows. You miss the forests. You miss the beavers and otters and grizzly bears. You miss the human beings. You're the river. You want them back. You want to feel the tickling of the sturgeon, the thrusting of the salmon. You want to carry food and soil to the ocean. You want to cover the meadows as you used to, and you want to give yourself to them, and you want them to give themselves to you as you've done forever, as they have too. Now, pretend you're a forest. You're the bark of trees and the hairy moss who hangs from them. You're the duff who becomes soil, who becomes trees, who becomes seeds, who becomes squirrels, who becomes owls, who becomes slugs, who becomes shrews, who becomes soil. You're the trees who cannot live without the fungi, who cannot live without the voles, who cannot live without the trees. You're the fire who cannot live without the trees, who cannot live without the woodpeckers, who cannot live without the beetles, who cannot live without the fire. You're the wind who speaks to the trees and the trees who speak to the wind. You're the birds who sing and the birds who do not. You're the salamanders, the ferns, the millipedes, the bumblebees who sleep on flowers waiting for the morning to warm you up so you can eat and fly on home. You too have lived through drought and flood, hot and cold, and you too miss the salmon. You miss the owls, the grizzly bears. You miss the rivers. You miss the human beings. You want them all back. You need them back or you will die.
Thank you, Derek. That's a beautiful note to end on, and I can't thank you enough for sharing everything that you're doing and for doing the work you're doing.
Well, thank you very much for the work you're doing.
Yeah, deeply appreciated, and glad to know you're out there.
Well, glad to know you're out there, too.
Thank you, Derek, and to your cat for joining us today for your interview.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yeah, and have a beautiful day. I'll be in touch with you again.
Bye.
Okay, bye.